This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe, and it's the Friday recap where we look back at some of our favorite segments from this week. Right now, we're going to go into the segment on architecture in Indiana, where we learn about some of the great old buildings you can find in cities and towns across the state, how we fit into the larger story of American architecture, and new development projects that are inspired by the past. We're joined by two professors from the School of Architecture at the University of Notre Dame, Chris Wilson and Philip Bess. Welcome to both of you. Chris, I'll start with you. How did you get interested in architecture? What sparked this passion for you?
Oh, my mother had an interest in history. She didn't get to go to college right out of high school, but went back when my youngest sister was in kindergarten. And she used to bring home the mimeograph notes from one of her history professors. And I would listen to, as an 11-year-old, listen to his lectures on the college radio station. So that instilled an interest in history. And then as an undergraduate, I was a slide projectionist as my student job and hooked up with a really great architectural historian who kind of gave me a way of looking at the built environment, and seeing history and culture in the built environment.
Philip, what about you?
I'm one of these people who had an undergraduate degree in a field other than architecture. And I never really even considered becoming an architect until, in sort of my early mid-20s, I was working on a construction project with a couple of guys who had designed the building. And I thought, oh, this would be kind of interesting. So I liked the idea of it, of architecture as a kind of wedding of contemplation and craft. And so that set me on a course of architectural study, which I would say the chief benefit of which is just kind of learning how to see the built environment. It wasn't something that I had paid much attention to, honestly, until I went to architecture school. And that's a great benefit of architecture school.
When I think of architecture, generally, I just think of blueprints and rulers and numbers. Is that accurate, or is there something more to it than that, Chris?
Well, that's the case with architect-designed buildings, civic buildings, large commercial buildings, the houses and mansions of the well-to-do. But a lot of what gets built are by vernacular means, builders who just come up in the building trades and build houses. And then over the last century, contractor builders, popular ways of designing and building. So there's a range of kind of learned architect design buildings, and then other pragmatic approaches to different building types.
Mm-hmm. And Philip, how would you characterize the architecture in South Bend compared to other places in Indiana? And maybe we can sort of broaden it a little bit in terms of, like, when you're characterizing architecture, is this just the outward appearance? Is it the way that it's built? Is it the materials?
Well, it's a great question, and it's kind of a complex answer. South Bend has been around for 150 years or so, and so there are buildings that have been here before the turn of the 20th century, and also very good ones that were built in the early period of the 20th century. And I want to some extent, that that period of American architectural history between about 1880 and 1940, there were really good buildings built almost everywhere in every region. It was America's, in some ways, America's best period of architectural production. And South Bend had a lot of those buildings. It still has some of those buildings left. What happened was in the 60s, a couple of things. One is that Studebaker closed down in South Bend and caused a serious economic recession within the city. A lot of people were thrown out of work. And then there was just a general national policy of post-World War II urban renewal that entailed the federal government giving cities a lot of money to tear down blocks of so-called, they called them slums, but cities were in need of money, and they did. And South Bend has never really recovered from that. It was only beginning to recover from that. So that South Bend is characterized by a lot of gaps in the block structure of the city, a lot of vacant blocks. And that has started to turn around. And I imagine we'll maybe talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah, definitely. And Chris, what was your impression of the architecture in South Bend when you moved there?
I was very impressed. I have lived and taught in New Mexico, which is a relatively poor state. And so right off the bat, the wealth of Indiana and the wealth of South Bend, from great farmland, but also from manufacturing from the middle of the 19th to, into the middle of the 20th century, produced such wealth that there's a lot of high quality architecture, really wonderful houses. And people that begin to learn about architecture think first about style. It's visual. You can engage it. So the Greek Revival, Italianate, Queen Anne, neoclassical houses, but also the building types, which get into economic and social layers. So the downtowns with their business blocks, with commercial space, shops on the ground floor, and then office or residential above. And I would say, not just South Bend, but the smaller towns on a smaller scale, tend to have, great historic downtowns with those business blocks. They tend to have great residential neighborhoods, or sometimes it's a main highway road running out of the town that's lined by great mansions. But as Phil said, urban renewal took down really a kind of donut of space around the downtowns, what were viewed as substandard multifamily housing. And those, in most cases, remain as surface parking lots to this day.
Wow. So it kind of changed the dynamic of the area in a way.
Yeah, it did, absolutely. And of course, it goes hand in hand with suburbanization and white flight to the suburbs after the Second World War, supported by federal regulation and financing mechanisms that channeled resources into the suburbs.
Phil, how would you characterize the architecture in South Bend compared to other parts of the state?
Well, let's see. I mean, I would say that one of the things that is a benefit of being at Notre Dame is that we have a great librarian, and one of the projects that she's done through the Architecture School Library is to document what South Bend looked like prior to about 1960, and it was really extraordinary. The quality of the streets, the quality of the buildings, both the public buildings and the kinds of mixed-use buildings that Chris describes, the housing stock. It was really quite superb, and I actually think that this was characteristic of most pre-1945 towns everywhere, including Indiana. So that, in my experience of looking around small towns in northern Indiana. They're very, a lot of them, they're very similar to each other, but there's a kind of uniform quality to them, that existed, prior to 1945. They were compact. They had a main street. They had civic buildings and, often a public square. And they were, really quite attractive places that now have gaps in them. Again, because of suburbanization, the devaluation of downtown, small towns, it's affected big cities and small towns. And so when you go to small towns now, you see these gaps, but generally, you'll find a lot of places where, the main street is intact. The buildings might not be completely full, but the aesthetic quality of them is quite good. What they need is, economic activity, and they need a financial basis, for thriving. But small town characters is really quite good.
It makes me wonder, does architecture influence a town and the way it's going to be built out? I mean, let's say there's no planner, they're planning out the city, but is it influenced by architecture, or does the town influence the way the architecture is going to come about?
Well, I would say a lot of what influences it is zoning and local habits of building, contemporary habits of building, which I said local habits of building, but the habits of building have become similar across the country in a certain kind of way, and not for the better. Chris mentioned the whole issue of suburban sprawl. And one of the consequences of that is that that's been going on for about 70 years at least. And one of the consequences of that is that we have developed zoning laws that produce that. And we've acquired habits of making places that are suburban. And so to try to work in the context of a traditional walkable mixed-use neighborhood, because that's really the difference between a post-war suburb and a city neighborhood or a small town, is that in the suburb you have to drive to all the different things that you do during the course of a day, whereas in a walkable town, you can walk to some things. Anyway, it's very hard to do that and to make those kinds of environments now. These environments like traditional small towns, but one of the advantages of them is that they have their infrastructure intact, right? And they have a lot of their buildings intact, and so there's a possibility for revival of small towns and city neighborhoods that can be locuses for infill development and rethinking this walkable mixed use pattern of life.
Right, right. I think we have a friend who wants to join us on the
call.
Like
there. It,
yeah. I just emailed my wife, who's in her office downstairs, asking for a little help with our exuberant dog. But Miriam, that's a really important and a complex question. Winston Churchill famously said, "First we shape our buildings, and then our buildings shape us." And so it's a chicken and an egg, kind of loop that keeps evolving, but is reinforcing. Beyond buildings, looking at districts, the way in which the United States ethnic and racial groups have been historically segregated into separate neighborhoods, often then with schools that are kind of pitched towards the place in society, the sort of occupations mm-hmm. that those people are expected to fulfill, so that a person staying in their place is both social and spatial.
We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb, and it's the Friday recap where we revisit a few conversations we had over the last week. A reminder, this show is not live. Next up, we're going to hear from Richard Antoine White, the first African-American to earn a doctorate in tuba performance, talk about his memoir. Aside from having to sort of chase people down, verify facts, did you ever feel reluctant to go back and revisit some stories, or have you always been open about your journey?
I've been fairly open, and I'm glad I get to share it with the world. I think, like my mom, it was the hand I was dealt, and I played it to the best of my ability. I wouldn't change a thing, because every single failure, every single success, every problem that I have had turned me into the person that I am today. And I like me when I get to work on me and make a better me. And I think my circumstances helped me become a better me. I hope that makes sense to the listeners.
Yeah, definitely it does. And when it comes to the trumpet, you mentioned that, you know, that was sort of the first thing that you started with, thinking that it would be easy, and then your parents kind of taking it away from you until you got your grades up. What compelled you to continue?
We continued playing music in sixth grade. I was trumpet number 18, I think, out of 32. And I was like, this is not working out, is it? I looked up and saw the sousaphone, the instrument you wear. I said, I want to play that, because it was only one. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion now. You know, when I'm in band or if I'm in orchestra, there's not a set of notes specifically set aside for African-Americans or a set of notes set aside for Caucasians. We all choose from the same notes. And what kept me going was that sense of collaboration, that sense of coming together to create something special. So I switched to tuba and never looked back.
And what is it that you find fascinating about the tuba that you've dedicated your life to this particular instrument?
Oh man, I believe in Tubby the tuba. I just want to play. I just want to play the melody. You know, the tuba is big. It's bulky. It's clumsy. I'm 6'5", 300 pounds. It's stereotype. It's the butt of all jokes. You know, but yet it's powerful. Yet it can dominate the orchestra. I often tell people my job in the orchestra is to show everyone else how much they suck at rhythm and pitch. I can make this shit float, or I can bring it down. So. The tuba is a beautiful instrument. It has a lot of power. And I think that's what attracts me to it, that I have a lot of life relationships to it, life characteristics that are identical to the tuba.
A lot of people will say there was something pivotal that led them to a certain instrument or to find out that they had a talent. Is there anything that led you down this path, or was it just by chance that you happened to pick up music and then find out that you were really good at it?
Ultimately, the way I would answer that question is that it's the village that kept me on path. It's the village that kept reoccurring in my life. The one thing that every institution and every teacher has in my life that worked out for me is that no one ever gave up on me. I would be foolish to sit here and tell you I did it. You know, I pulled myself up by the boots and strap. First of all, not everyone has boots and a strap. Second of all, you can work as hard as you can in this country and still fail. I credit the village for keeping me going. I credit the village for assisting in my work. And that pivotal moment kept repeating itself throughout my life.
And I think your story highlights just the importance of community and folks coming together.
I definitely believe that. And I think a lot of times we fall short because no one wants to reach the point of exhaustion. But exhaustion is where new beginnings happen. When you've given it all you have, now you get to think about something that you haven't done. You know, we have a systematic problem in our country where we're quick to give help, maybe level 5 help. And if you don't achieve or excel at level 5 help, then you're a failure. You're not working hard. But we all have different strengths and weaknesses. What if this person just needs level 6 help and then they would elevate? I think we have to be willing to meet students where they are. And then we also have to find something that we love about each student so that we can establish ultimate endurance and that we don't give up on them. And I'm lucky that I had those things.
That's a really good point. And I'm just trying to marinate on it a little bit here, just thinking about, you know, maybe we do have help and support, but maybe we kind of leave people hanging too. We expect them to take it and be amazing. But there's more to it.
I agree. I think excellence is void of color. It's void of gender. It's void of bias. It's on the level or not. And what we have to provide is resources. If you want to be a Formula One race car driver, I'm saying that because of Indiana or Indy 5, and I give you a nice Toyota Camry and you go to the Indy 500, good luck with that. You know, that car is not equipped, no matter how talented you are. So I think what we want to do is establish the resources to allow everyone to compete at the level of excellence. But under no circumstances do we want to lower the bar of excellence.
If you weren't a musician, do you think you would be doing something completely outside of music?
Oh, I know exactly what I'd be doing if I wasn't a musician. I'd be a football player.
And why is that?
I wanted to be a football player. Like, I'm 6'5", 300 pounds. I broke my hip, and that's how I gravitated to the school for the arts and the tuba. I wanted to be a football player. I was supposed to be a football player. Ultimately, now I'm justified in my older years. I think maybe I would have been hit or something and been paralyzed. So the universe said, let's leave this football thing alone. But I love football. If I weren't a tubist in a different life or earlier and I didn't break my hip playing football, I would have been a football player. I broke my hip, and so I was like, well, what else can I do? Well, I can play tuba. I showed up at the Baltimore School for the Arts with crutches, with a sousaphone, the instrument that you wear. Auditions were over. The director just happened to be there because he forgot a document or something. And he said, can I help you? And I said, yeah, I'm here to audition. And he said, what? Auditions were yesterday. And I looked him in the eyes with serious determination, said, but I'm here now. He said the audacity or the determination made him go, well, I have to hear this young man. And the rest is history. I auditioned for him and I got into the Baltimore School for the Arts. Statistically, I think they'll hear 600 kids and they'll accept 35 of them. If you're wondering about the odds.
That's pretty amazing to be able to get in with those kinds of odds. What was that audition experience like? Did you expect that they'd be like, okay, fine, we'll let you audition even though you're a day late?
Well, you're the first person to ask that question. I think it was awkward is the word I would use. Because I played some Mozart thing that I had, and I had learned to read music by rote. I learned on a cassette tape. If you don't know what that is, I think you can Google it.
I know. I'm not that young.
Okay. I put a tape in and it said, "Hello, this is B flat. Do pause the tape. When you have mastered B flat, continue." That's how I learned. So I really couldn't read music. So Mr. Ford put a piece of music in front of me and he pointed to a note and he said, "Do you know what this is?" And I illustrate. I say, "Yeah, that's this." I pushed down my first finger. He said, "Yeah, but do you know what this note called?" I say, "Yeah, I say it's this." No note name. Just push my finger down. He said, "Oh, but you don't know the note name of this." I was like, "Man, it's this." Then he said, "Okay, well, how about if I play this on the piano? Can you play that back?" And I was like, "Of course." So I played it back. He said, "I'll be back." He left the room, made a phone call, and came back in and said, "You must be the luckiest kid on the planet. We're going to accept you into the Baltimore School of the Arts."
That's amazing. Accepted me.
Yeah,
what was that feeling like? Like, I mean, did you expect that quick of a decision?
No, I was very green. I left there going, "Okay, I'll see you next year." Right. And I got to call my dad. He said, "So how was it?" I was like, "I got in. No problem." That's what's going through my mind. But I casually just said, "I got in." I didn't realize at the moment what was happening or how historical it would become. You know, I just went up there and played tuba and did what I do. And I'm glad that they accept students based on potential and not where you necessarily are. I think that's another thing we have to change about our system in terms of having the ability to meet students where they are. Everyone won't walk into the front door where you think they should be. And we have a responsibility to be good stewards of the education we're providing. And I think it's not fair to ask a student to check their personality or characteristics at the door. You should allow them to be themselves and develop from there.
Yeah, and I wonder, looking back, just if these types of things were implemented, where folks might be, not to put regret and be like, if only, you know, they had these systems and then you could be something amazing now, but just the idea of meeting students where they're at and giving them that chance to grow rather than like everyone has to be at the same level at the same time.
Yeah, and you know, I often speak about this because I don't think every single time the right formula was there for me, but I've developed this ideology of instead of because I have this, I can't do that, because they didn't give me this, I can't do that. I think in spite of everything that's wrong and everything that I didn't get, I'm still going to show you. And that's my attitude.
So when you went to the Baltimore School for Arts, did that change sort of the level of your thoughts towards music and to make it even more like of a professional career goal?
I was exposed to a lot of different things. It was a difficult transition, not just musically. It was a difficult transition in terms of being an articulate person in academia, you know, pronouncing words axe instead of ask, or there's nothing strong with that. And I was trying to say there's nothing wrong with that. And so in my mind, all these tools of opportunity and betterment that were being provided to me were perceived as people trying to make me white. Mm. I didn't see them as tools to be a better me. I just say, you're trying to turn me into something I'm not. You're trying to make me white. So that transition was extraordinary. Once they asked me to be on TV and I found out that you can get scholarship, which translated to the street mind that I had into money, it was no turning back. I said, you can get money playing the tuba. Like, really? Is somebody? and then when they said to me, you can get thousands, they didn't say hundreds. I said, wait a minute, time out. I can practice this thing right here. And somebody going to give me thousands of dollars to go to school. I'm finna practice. And I got to school at 7 o'clock every morning because I was determined to get some money. I was going to make some thousands. That trajectory changed. That changed my work ethic. That changed my attitude. Because at that point, I think I realized that there will always be people more talented than me. There were talented people in the school and smarter probably. But I decided that no one's going to outwork me. And I control that.
I'm taking in all you're saying. I feel like I'm having a masterclass, so this is great. Of just determination and strength and pushing through when all the odds are pretty much stacked against you. You love the tuba. It's an instrument that you say could speak to anyone. Can you explain what that means?
It means that, for me, musical notes are void of the complications of the alphabets. Like, sometimes I think chatter is too much sometimes. And I think a song can speak to you. A song can speak to the soul. A rhythm can speak to the soul. You know, there are different elements of music. And I think motion is different from emotion. For example, when I entered school for the arts, I couldn't really count rhythms, but I didn't have the motion part of music down. But boy, did I have the emotional part down because of my life experience. And I think that's what I mean when I say the tuba can speak to anyone. Like, I can absorb your feelings and try to translate them into a song. We can all relate to a song. And the beautiful thing is, you can hear a song, I can hear a song, we can hear the same song, but yet it means something different to each one of us. That's magic. Oh, sorry, the puppies.
Oh, no, that's all right. They're excited. They're enjoying the topic. Are they tuba fans when you play your tuba?
Oh, yes. One of them will sleep and won't leave my side. And when I open the door from the studio, she's going to be right there on the floor.
Well, when it comes to also like the tuba and just music in general, is it ever too late to learn music?
I don't think it's too late to do anything. If anyone's out there feeling like, oh, I should have did this, I'm too old. The best part about every day is that you're not done yet. That's my motto. You can start now. And, you know, time is the one thing we can't manipulate. You know, we all start living and dying the instant we're born. I don't intend to really work past 62 years of age because I realize that no matter how successful I get, I can't buy more time. So I need that time to do what I want to do. And I have a huge fear of leaving this earth before I get to do everything I want to do. And maybe a realization that I won't get to do everything that I want to do. And that makes me sad. But I don't think it's ever too late.
What are some of those things that you want to do that you think you don't have time?
I think some of them will get accomplished. So my bucket list is I want to make a yoga CD because I think it's the one category I probably can win a Grammy in. I want to say, and you know, I did an interview the other day that's led to some offers. I want to be the first musician to say I performed on all 7 continents, Australia, Africa, and Antarctica are left, and I'm getting invitations to Antarctica now, so it's gonna happen. And my last bucket list thing, which is I'm working on the most right now, is I want to build a raw tuba ranch. It'll be my home and it'll be a place of fellowship. It'll have a stage and a place where if you're having a bad day, come on a raw tuba ranch, 24/7, ramen noodle, chili, and beer. If you can't drink beer, we'll have some Kool-Aid for you, and we'll have barracks where you can stay if you overindulge. But those are my 3 bucket list items currently.
So you have some ties to Indiana. You came here for your master's and doctorate in tuba performance. Why did you decide to come here?
I love Indiana Hoosiers all the way, and I'll be there, I think, next week. I'm coming to Indiana. It's like I'm there all the time. My mentor, teacher, Daniel Brantoni, is like my dad. IU represents excellence. You know, at IU, you fail a class, they don't lower the bar of excellence. They tell you, oh, I'm just unfortunate you failed the class, but we'll be here when you retake this class, okay? So I chose Indiana simply because it had the best track record of tuba players getting jobs. There is not a professor that has a better track record than Mr. Daniel Parentoni.
Is it hard to find a program for tuba? It was my understanding, I think, that Indiana and maybe somewhere else is the only place where you can get a PhD.
I think that's not exactly accurate. You can get into a lot of schools for tuba. I think in our country, unlike England, we don't understand the difference between a doctorate of music, which is a DM, or a doctor of musical arts, a DMA. Mm. I'm the first African-American to get a doctorate of music, a DM, and only a select few institutions offered. I think right now, Florida and Indiana University, and the difference is in the curriculum. People say, oh, isn't it the same thing? No, sir. How about you go look up the curriculum and figure out why I started a degree in 2000 and didn't finish until 2012.
That's a long time. Yeah, that's some dedication.
I mean, I left. I was working, but it is an intense degree. Everyone will tell you it's one of the hardest doctors to get. I'm grateful that I was there because it was part of my history. And I think that to get in the studio like IU, yeah, it's hard. It's really hard. He has an extraordinary wait list. I think he feeds probably, I would say, a good 30, 40% of other schools based on the students that he can't take, and they're top-notch students.
So it's pretty amazing the trajectory that your life has taken to get into all of these very hard-to-get-into programs.
Well, Indiana, another thing I should say, Indiana is tuba royalty. I mean, William Bell was the first teacher. Second teacher was Mr. Harvey Phillips, the Paganini of tuba. And I mean, he created Oktoberfest, which is happening now. So today, I think, is October the 6th in Mr. Phillips' world. He created Tuba Christmas, Tuba Valentine's Day. If we could put tuba on it, we'd do it. And Tuba Christmas was, you know, created many years ago. He called out Rockefeller and said, hey, I want to have Tuba Christmas here. They're like, who are you? I'm Mr. Phillips. He told them to check his references, and then they gave him Oktoberfest.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break. Once again, we have Richard beatboxing on his tuba in a collaborative track with his brother, William. We'll be back in 90 seconds. Don't throw up, I get it back. Then I never lose it, then I'm cruising. If you understand me, then you get it back. Because you know I'm moving. I'm only trying to make one day. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. It's the Friday recap where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this week. For our final segment, we'll hear from an IU professor who's written a book about how to have conversations about race, racism, and politics in the classroom. Marcus Kroom, assistant professor of literacy, culture, and language education at Indiana University Bloomington, and author of Real Talk, How to Discuss Race, Racism, and Politics in 21st Century American Schools. Before the break, you touched upon sort of the political aspect of this, and there's legislation that's being pushed. I know that Senate Bill 167 here in Indiana was proposing to put limitations on conversations about race, religion, and politics, and it ultimately didn't go through. What were your thoughts when you heard about this?
I don't know much about that bill. I am hearing, continuing, I should say, to hear about House Bill 1134, and even that bill has changed, so I don't at all want to make any hard and definitive statements about either one, because they're just moving and changing and morphing. But yeah, I mean, the impression that I, you know, came away with is the extent to which not just H Bill, you know, 1134, but any kinds of bills across the United States. And I actually refer to legislation in Tennessee. So I address this in the book very forthrightly. Indiana's public legislation was not on my radar at that time. It was, you know, maybe in progress, but that's something that was introduced after my book was already published. So it's not mentioned. But I do say that, you know, it was already clear that a number of states might do similar legislation as to what's in Tennessee and other places. And so, without making any definitive points about the bill one way or the other in terms of its language and, you know, all that, my question is, you know, does that bill or any of these other bills meet the level of rigor that I recommend for educators in the Real Talk protocol? And so, as I said before, those five steps for the Real Talk protocol are to plan, to preview, to put it in context, to point out the evidence, and to pin up and return. And so if I just kind of take that model of what's in the book and think about all of this legislation that's popping up now, you know, one question we could ask is, well, how well planned is, you know, in this case, House Bill 1134, especially in light of conflicting bills like House Bill 1182, which would require that school board candidates state a political affiliation on the ballot. That's what House Bill 1182 proposes. And so if the aim of House Bill 1134 is to reduce the level of politics in schools and classrooms, why advocate for political affiliations in school board elections with bills such as House Bill 1182? So, you know, again, the question of planning there, as I recommend that educators do, you need to be well planned with how you approach the Real Talk protocol. So I would just, again, reflect through that lens on what's happening legislatively. And also, with whom did the legislators preview HB 1134? What was suggested by those who previewed that legislation? And what did they say should, you know, how should that bill be refined to the benefit of Indiana residents? Especially those Hoosiers who are not well served by Indiana schools. And we have a number of examples, again, going back to evidence and what we can pull very clearly from the public record, there are a number of Hoosiers who are not yet well served in Indiana schools. So did they preview what's in that bill or any other bill that affects their child's education and their community? And then thirdly, how is House Bill 1134 connected to the context of American schooling, education research, and public issues? For example, public issues like school funding allocations. That's a public issue. Known racial disparities. That's a public issue. Prevalent misinformation about education. That's a very clear public issue. And there are some Hoosiers that'll talk about having the experience of repeatedly unfair decision making that harms them or ignores them. Those are all very, you know, clear public issues in this state and across the United States of America. And then in terms of pointing out the evidence, well, point out the evidence that informs House Bill 1134. Is this evidence reliable? Is it publicly available for anyone to access? These are the kind of questions that educators are urged and suggested that they ask and work through as they carry out the Real Talk protocol. And again, if we just turn it in the direction of these bills, we could ask a similar question. And finally, is there a pin up and return kind of approach to the legislation? In other words, does House Bill 1134 explicitly state an open-ended view of all that is addressed in the bill? Is the bill designed to be revisited and revised regularly in light of new information or new conditions? Again, following the Real Talk protocol, teachers are expected to pin up and return and come back to these conversations with the assumption that we have not solved it by one conversation. We have not solved it even by a series of conversations. These are huge, major public ongoing issues that require us to revisit it and to update in light of new information, new conditions. Is the legislation process and this bill in particular informed by that kind of an approach? And so, you know, again, it's not about attacking this or that part of the bill in terms of language, but just, you know, broadly using the model that I suggest to teachers and asking of, you know, this legislation, all other legislation related to education, have we done those five steps?
Would it be fair to say that education has become politicized because it's an easy target to go after?
No, it's not politicized because it's easy. It's politicized because it's connected to society and to human needs and human interests, et cetera. There's no way that education can be non-political, if you will. The schooling that we have in the United States is based on states, taxpayers, right? Elections in school board or others. So there's no way to disentangle schooling from politics. A part of how schooling came to be is because of politics and the values and the interests of those political fights are very clear. If you go back and look at the record, you can see what the value was, right? Who is valued, who's not valued, who's a priority, who is not a priority, right? In terms of budgets, in terms of actual policies and practices, in terms of all sorts of things, you know, discipline data. I mean, all of it. There's all sorts of evidence that makes it very clear in terms of looking at it from a practice perspective, what priorities are. And so it's not because it's an easy target. It's because it's a part and a reflection of who we are, not just as individuals, but also as a collective, who we regard as worth respect, worth dignity, worth the goods that we all want. That's a part of why education is a political issue.
So it seems like also if we look at it from that perspective, as you've mentioned, what we see in schools is going to be reflected out in society, depending on how our education goes.
Absolutely right. And that's exactly what I'm getting at with the illustration that I include in the book. I'm going to flip to the book quickly to jar my memory on page five in the book. I have a diagram of the reality imperative, and that includes human beings living in society and learning in schools. And all three of those elements are intertwined and cannot be disentangled. And schools have a need to respond to society. And in like manner, society is responsive in some ways to schools, for good or ill. Sometimes it's a good kind of response, and sometimes not so much. So yeah, I mean, this is ongoing. This is one of the points I really try to hit home and really bring to people's awareness through the book, that these issues, these public issues like race, racism, and politics, these public issues are ongoing. Most of them, if not all of them, existed before you were born. So what's the likelihood that there's going to be a quote unquote quick fix, or a quote unquote easy fix, or a one-time conversation and we're done? Now, that doesn't mean we can't make progress. It doesn't mean we can't take definitive action for good and to stop harms. That doesn't mean that at all. But this idea of kind of a one and done is not realistic. It's unreal to refer to it as I do in the book. That's an unreal way to think about it. And it does more harm than good.
It makes me wonder if some folks are thinking, well, we are going to discuss these topics. We're going to make a checklist and say, we discussed this, this, and this, we're good to go. But really it's something that needs to be continuously, as you mentioned, reviewed and looked upon and adjusted and stuff like that.
Yeah. And that's the reason why it's a protocol and it's not a checklist. I'm not saying that you go through the checklist and then have a party. It is a protocol. It is a way of understanding how we do business, if you will. These are the practices and processes that we have agreed to engage in, make adjustments, if need be, change, you know, discard, you know, if it turns out not to be helpful, absolutely discard it. Right. As a researcher, that doesn't hurt my feelings. We as researchers have to adapt and change all the time. That's not unusual for the work that I do. But it very much is something that we have to commit ourselves to, and not for any small or selfish, even kind of a narrow understanding of what's at stake and what it's about, but one that's really broader, one that's connected to something bigger than, you know, a political cycle or a particular funder or whatever, any number of other things that could be the key interest or the aim. We've got to rethink ourselves as human beings and rethink the human beings around us in some fundamental ways that allows us to really do the sort of things that we've all said that we value, that we all say we think is important.
Indiana isn't necessarily alone in the debate. As you mentioned, you were looking at some other states with regards to what's being discussed in classrooms, but our state seems to be in the spotlight a lot more. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't know quite what to make of that yet. I'm new as a resident to the state of Indiana, so I have a lot to learn about my new home state. So I don't know quite what to make of that. I'm aware of, you know, some really important history with how schools were rearranged, in specifically in the Indianapolis area, Marion County area. So I'm aware of that history. I'm aware of the history of segregation in schooling in this state. You know, those kind of a broad historical points, you know, those are things that I've been made aware of and read about. But, you know, in terms of details as to why Indiana is kind of, you know, in people's minds, either locally or nationally, I really can't say. I don't know. I mean, we certainly obviously had before this current federal administration, of course, the vice president was from the state. So maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. But the point is, I think that's true based on what I'm seeing. But I really don't. I'm not sure why at this point.
What can folks do to support efforts to have real conversations and really listen and take in the information and do something with it? You know, maybe they're going to go through the Real Talk protocol, but how can they actually make sure that they've taken action and there's something coming out of it?
Yeah, I think that people can choose to value actual information over whatever assumption may be in mind or circulating at the time. And what I mean by that is once we actually say, you know, we're going to ask the question, we're not going to assume the answer before we even ask, right? We're going to have the conversation, and we're going to have the conversation not to make my point, but to try to really understand where you're coming from and see if I can, you know, get a sense of how you came to the point of view and the worldview that you're clearly holding, right? That is a choice that we can or can't make. It's up to us. So if we make the choice to really try to move away from just assumptions to actual information, I think that that move in itself will not only help overall, but I think it has the possibility to convince people, you know, personally in ways that they may not be convinced by other means, right? So if someone individually decides to kind of suspend their assumption and try to really listen and go after actual information, they may shock themselves with what they find and what they discover from suspending the assumption and trying to really get at real information. They may not be. They may find out exactly what they thought the case was from the very beginning. So, you know, I'm not at all being naive, but the point is that's a choice for us to make. If we really want to know something, we have literally taken people to the moon. We just recently had in the private sector, people traveling to space. I mean, we can figure out anything we really want to figure out. I don't think it's a matter of capacity. I don't think it's a matter of not having anywhere to go to begin to try to understand or make sense of these kinds of things. I think we just have to make the decision that that's what we want to do. And that also is tied to honesty as well. I'll mention that because if we're not honest about what our aims are, we will put out a proxy for what's really, you know, the agenda for us. And so I think that's another thing I should add is that the more we're honest about what we really want, what our real aim is and putting it out there, as opposed to putting up proxies to stand in, so to speak, or to represent in some way or maybe even hide what we really want to do. I think that's another way to make progress as well, because if we keep putting up proxies for other things that are really not what we're after, we're not going to get anywhere. Because we're not dealing honestly with each other, and even when someone might attempt to collaborate or compromise or whatever it is that they need to do, it won't lead to a resolution because that's not really what you want anyway.
If our listeners want to learn more about your book or any workshops or things that you conduct, where can they go?
Right now, in terms of the public, I mean, I've got some research things and publications and stuff, you know, in progress on the more scholarly side. But the book is really it, and again, it's not. It is directed specifically to educators, no question, but absolutely parents, because I'm hoping that parents will indeed support educators as they endeavor to do real talks, legislators, because I certainly hope that they will support educators as they endeavor to do these real talks, journalists, et cetera. All of these different audiences, all of these different stakeholders in our schooling as Americans, as Hoosiers in the state of Indiana, all of these different stakeholders can draw something from this book. And again, I hope the most important thing that you draw from the book is that we need to be supportive of educators who are not responding to a problem that they themselves have created. This is not an issue that they're creating and somehow, you know, ginning up in schools and classrooms. They're responding to something that's already there. They're responding to a condition and to issues not of their own making individually, but is a reflection of our broader society, of history, of policy making and policy decisions that some of them don't even know the origins of. All of this is a real, more honest way of beginning to account for why we're having to have these real talks in the first place.